Hi, and welcome to this episode of Security Nation, the podcast where, as you probably know by now, we talk to interesting people doing cool things to advance security in some magical, mysterious, enchanted way. I am your host, Jen Ellis. I'm Rapid7's VP of Community and Public Affairs. Nobody knows what it means, least of all me. And with me is my amazing co-host, Dud Beardsley. Hey, Miss Beardsley, how you doing?
Hi, Jen. I'm great. Hopefully we'll reduce some of the mystery, but keep the enchantedness.
So, this week we're picking up the thread that we've had. We've had a little bit of discussion around this on and off through Copocalypse. Can we? No, that doesn't work very well. I don't like it.
Coronageddon.
Coronageddon. Fine. We'll just go with that one. All right. So we've talked a little bit about the new normal, which is, you know, ironic me talking about normal. And we talked a little bit about the move to adopt remote working. And obviously you've talked about Zoom 1,001 times. And we've talked a little bit about virtual conferences. We had that great conversation with John Strand, which if people haven't listened to it, they should go and totes check it out because it was great. And so today we're picking up that thread a little bit more, and we're talking about security trainings being taken virtual. This is in light of news that that Hacker Summer Camp is definitely going to be virtual, which I think is a really smart decision. We love it. And so now all of those people who do amazing trainings at Hacker Summer Camp, which is, you know, kind of crazy big business, are now like feverishly taking those trainings and making them work online, which is very exciting. So with us today, our special guest is Joe Fitzpatrick, who is a trainer researcher at securinghardware.com and a veteran of providing excellent training. I imagine, Joe, you are now taking time out of your incredibly busy schedule of trying to turn those trainings virtual to come talk to us. So thank you very much for doing that. We really appreciate it. Welcome.
Well, thank you. And when my business is traveling all over the place to go to large groups of people and teach them, I don't actually have a lot of that happening right now, so I've got the time to go and make this training remote.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Right. I'm sure you've just been sitting around, you know, twiddling your thumbs, wondering what to do with yourself until we picked up the phone, and then you were like, yes, now I have a mission.
With training, January and February is kind of the slow part of the year. And so, you know, it's nice to have that time to relax. You know, everybody spent their December training budget or their last year training budget in December. So now January, February, I can take some time off, get some stuff done. And then March comes around and everything's canceled.
You're like, this wasn't in the plan. I think lots of people are saying this wasn't in the plan at the moment.
Yeah.
So now you are presumably preparing for not Vegas, as I will call it. Uh-huh. So what does preparing for not Vegas entail?
Well, so I do hardware training in particular, which is a little bit different from software training. I've always been jealous of the people who show up with a USB drive and have like virtual machine images in the cloud and then like start teaching class. Because last year, I believe I shipped about 800 pounds of equipment for all the combined classes and stuff that I was working on.
Yeah.
I show up with like equipment to hack on, the tools to hack with. And that's kind of hard. It's hard to do hardware hacking without the hardware, right? So figuring out how to do that remotely is an interesting challenge.
So let's take a step back, because I did kind of like fly us straight into the belly of the beast. You do hardware hacking. What kind of hardware hacking? Like, what kind of hardware do you focus on?
So the classes I've been doing focus a lot on kind of like the embedded Linux type systems. So you've got a Wi-Fi router, you've got an IP camera, you've got a Raspberry Pi class, you know, embedded device. Typically what happens with IoT manufacturers is they get an off-the-shelf SoC, get the off-the-shelf, you know, software stack on top of it, and they throw their fancy web app and...
What's an SoC?
SoC, system on chip, not system, a security operations center, very different thing. I get confused sometimes.
Yes, right.
But, you know, most IoT vendors, they don't know what the hardware is underneath. So in my class, we basically go and we look at the hardware and from observation, figure out what it is and then figure out how we can use, you know, a little bit of hardware, a few wires here and there to communicate with it and basically use physical access to give software privilege.
And you've been running trainings now for a while, right? And
yeah.
Your trainings are very successful.
So far.
So how frequently do you run a training, and how many people would typically be in a class? Help us understand what it looks like.
I end up doing training typically in a normal year, roughly a training a month. The training's 2 to 5 days long, and it's anywhere from 10 to 30 people. Some of them are private trainings on site for customers. Some of them are public trainings at conferences, like Black Hat. I also run another event, Hardware Security Training, which is me and several other hardware security trainers who get together and put our trainings together in kind of a separate event.
And you use it, so, and we've used this term a lot, right? Training. And I think one of the complications, right, of this year is that training isn't teaching. It's a different experience. And maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit, because like you say, like hardware training remotely, like hardware's there in your hand, right? But there are other things that go on, like in an in-person training.
Yeah. So it's funny to go and look at look at a slate. You have 2 days to teach a bunch of people a bunch of stuff. And like, what do you choose to cover? What do you want them to come away with? And what do you eliminate? Because, you know, I could sit there and I could talk every day for 8 hours a day about hardware for a month, but no one wants to hear that. Maybe some people do, but I don't know. I don't know why anybody would pay for that. So I got to figure out in 2 days, what are the most important points that people need to come away with, right? So I want to figure out the skills they want, figure out how to give hands-on in-class practice to do those things so that when they go home after 2 days, they can repeat that. And that's my objective when I do an in-person training and I have 2 days to fill that. So I have a combination of lectures and hands-on labs and lots of Q&A. One thing that I find really is helpful is, you know, there's a lot of very lecture-focused, lecture-heavy training. But in my experience, when someone's trying to learn something, right, you can lecture and give them 10 important points to remember, and they'll remember 2, 3, 5, 8 of them, depending on the person. But if you let them go and try and do it themselves, and they have a problem and they can't figure it out and they have to ask a question like, hey, where do I put this wire? Hey, what's this command line? Right. Since they've asked the question, then they get the answer. Then it's far more ingrained than if I had just lectured that answer. Does that make sense?
For sure.
So how did you get into this, and how long have you been doing it?
You know, my summer job through high school was teaching at a summer camp. I got through college and grad school as a teaching assistant. So I've been done a little bit of teaching.
So it was kind of ingrained.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, it's funny. My mom does technical training as well. She did application training in the late 80s and then 90s when suddenly Everybody had a computer on their desk and didn't know how to do it. So she's been doing training for her whole career. I was working at Intel in a product security group, and we needed to kind of expand the knowledge of hardware security, but we couldn't hire, you know, 500 people for a hardware security group. So we needed to kind of go and give kind of the intro of hardware security basics to all the people who are doing validation in the company. And so I didn't develop that material, but I picked up and kind of did a lot of the teaching of it, and really enjoyed it. Wanted to do kind of hands-on instead of lecture-based stuff. And so when it was time for me to be done at a big corporate job, I knew exactly what I wanted to do.
That's very cool. So now you've been doing it since then, and that sounds like it's been a while. And typically in a Black Hat, for example, do you train every year at Black Hat?
Yeah, for the past several years, every year.
And your classes, presumably, I'm guessing from Todd's crazy class lust, that you pretty much sell out every year. Is that?
Most of the time.
Like one class or multiples?
So last year I decided to go all out. Instead of doing, I've done 4 day classes. I've done 2 2-day classes over the 4 days. Last year, I did four unique 2 day classes over the 4 days. I had 8 assistants who were helping me. So I was hopping between 2 classrooms with the beginner pair of classes and the advanced pair of classes. It turned into a big deal.
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm exhausted just listening to you talk about it.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, by the time they get around to the training, the trainers party, you must have just been like,
Yeah, and I last year I definitely overdid it, and I remember by the time Black Hat was done, I was like, oh yeah, DEF CON, and I basically stayed in my room and at the pool and vegetated for 2 days, which was great.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that actually sounds like a very civilized way of doing DEF CON. And talking of sitting around a pool, you're actually on vacation as you speak to us right now, aren't you? You're actually very nicely taking time out of your crazy vacation to talk to us while you're in the wilderness. Is that fair?
Yeah, we had to wake up at 6:30 this morning because there was a bear on the back deck.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I don't, like, did you wake up so that you could be like, ooh, there's a bear on the back deck? Or was it more so you could be like, run?
My brother-in-law, who's been here since, March, he was going fishing this morning. And so 6:30, he's going to go fishing and notices there's a bear trying to climb up on the back deck. And so he starts yelling at it. So, of course, everybody wakes up.
Apart from the bear, who's kind of like, whatever, dude. Very cool. All right, so this year, before everything went nuts, what was the plan for Vegas? Like, were you doing, I'm guessing you were not gonna do four classes again.
Yeah, actually I was dumb enough to try that. So I had four classes in the schedule, and actually have some people who have been assisting me for several years who were going to lead those classes. So I would be the support person and they would be the leader. So, you know, trying to get more people in the ability to go and teach these classes. And then this all came down and I realized pretty quickly that even if, you know, Black Hat was going to happen, I wasn't sure I wanted to go to it. So I'd been kind of brainstorming long before the announcement of the decision about how to make it happen. I realized I could get one class done in time for Black Hat, and one class made sense, the introductory class, because that's the one that has the biggest demand. There's a lot of logistics to figure out. And then once you figure out the logistics, then there's all the details.
Right. So how's that going?
Yeah, I'm super curious how this is all going to work, you know?
So two sides of it. There's logistics of equipment, right? And, you know, Black Hat is usually people coming from all over the place to take a class. And, you know, from a privacy perspective, like, I just teach the class to them. So we got to get equipment to these people to take the class. So I have to go and get that equipment to Black Hat. Black Hat has to distribute it to people, which sometimes includes international shipping, right? And typically I reuse equipment, which is great because I have equipment that I've fine-tuned and honed and everything. But the reality is, like, I can't just get the equipment back. So now it's you get the equipment and you keep the equipment, which means instead of needing, you know, 30 of everything, now I need 30 of everything every time I teach a class of 30.
Oh, wow.
You know, so now it's, you know, frantically ordering stuff from China, which has some limitations on shipping and throughput right now, to get all the equipment in hand so I can go and distribute it. There's a few custom boards in the kit and there's other stuff that needs to be modified. So it's not yet a, like, you know, this off-the-shelf product, this off-the-shelf, this off-the-shelf product, but it's getting there. So the other side of it, though, is the actually delivering the content. So there's a lot of web-based training stuff available, which is great. There's lots of resources. There's lots of how-tos. But it turns out that InfoSec training is actually really good compared to most of what I see for training. So when you get into this realm of, like, what is online training? Like, why do people do online training? Well, until last year, number one was for cost. They didn't want to send people to training, so they did an online training. The other was that training is not to actually learn stuff. Training is all about compliance, right? So, oh, we need to give our employees a 30-minute course on compliance with this, or a 30-minute coverage of this in order to meet this requirement. And that's where all this, like, money comes into huge high-volume training, right? Whereas the technical, the InfoSec training, we are more about delivering skills that people are actually going to use. Skills that people want so that they can go and use, as opposed to skills that people don't really care about, that they're required to receive, that their management has to come up with the way to tease them into clicking through enough links to get the checkbox to get the compliance.
Right. So typically your online training experience is like a grudge buy where, like, everybody taking it doesn't want it. You know, it's all like anti-corruption stuff or, you know, sexual harassment in the workplace, right? Like the kinds of, like, boring HR mandated trainings compared to your stuff, which is like stuff that people actually want to do and will be paying attention and will get mad if it sucks.
And I mean, I'm really seeing this reminds me of how lucky I am that I get to teach something that people want to learn.
Yeah.
Not every trainer gets that opportunity.
Yeah.
So the other thing is you go on the internet and there's all these resources about, oh, you can use our system to set up your training and you can use our system to set up your training. And there's all these, like, you know, there's very interesting price tiers. There's like the $100 tier, then there's like the $3,500 tier, and it's like, why would I pay $3,500 for you to share some videos? And they all cater to this like metrics of your compliance, of your training. And the other thing they cater to is sales funnels, right? I don't know if you ever heard this phrase before, but like, it's this whole deal where, you know, oh, you have a training where you're going to learn something, but they don't actually teach you anything until you give them your email address and then you start a conversation and then it turns out it's just a sales pitch, right?
You teach them how to buy your product.
Exactly.
Yeah, so you're painting kind of a depressing view of this whole training shenanigan. So where does that leave you for, you know, your preparations for this year and moving forward on teaching people how to fish with a pH?
Some things that I've discovered both in trial runs as well as like in reading a lot about this and in, you know, figuring out what I'm going to do for my class is when I was doing my in-person class, I often tried to keep my lectures to about half an hour, which is a good amount of time for engagement, get enough information and get some interaction. And then we'd have about 90 minutes of lab time where people would work on a challenge, a problem, an activity of some sort. When you get to like an online training, it doesn't work the same way because people are not as engaged, right? The lectures are not interactive. They're more dictating, right? So what I've kind of done is I basically sliced my class up and I have 5 to 10 minute lectures and 20 to 30 minute labs, right? So every lecture lab unit in my in-person class is sliced into 3 smaller ones for this. So that also caters to the fact that, like, you know, there are some constraints of training, right? So training intact in a bunch of people in the same place at the same time, there's a lot of synchronous stuff that has to happen. But if you're going to online training, right, people are in different time zones, people have different work schedules and family commitments, and some of them are still working from home or always work from home. So taking advantage of that asynchronous nature is really helpful. So something I had always considered doing was flipping the classroom. This is the concept where you take lectures, instead of giving the lectures in class and then having homework be at home, you give the lectures as videos to watch at home, and then you have the classroom time to be like work. So this is something that like more like a grade school and upper education have been trying. And I've always thought about it, but people have seem very reluctant to it. But this is my opportunity to take advantage of it. So I've got those 5 to 10 minute lectures recorded so you can watch them. You can watch them before the class. You can watch them after the class. You can watch them 3 times, which for some people is really helpful. It's disappointing. Sometimes people, you know, will sit through the lecture and they get 90% of it, but there's those one little pieces they didn't know were important. And so like they have to go and re-grab those. By having these recorded lectures available for people to re-watch, suddenly you're taking advantage of this asynchronous nature and giving people more opportunity to learn more things better.
It sounds like a very Khan Academy style of betterer learning, where yeah, you can pause, you can rewind, you can like redo the thing. If you were spaced out or you responded to a Slack notification or something, you can just stop and back up 5 minutes.
Or a kid's knock on the door, or a bear is on the deck, or you know.
Yep. Or if you get a bear, right?
Or if the bear wants to take the training.
Don't teach bears how to hardware hack. That would be a bad idea. I don't want to be speciesist or anything, but that's. It's not a good skill for bears.
So that sounds, I mean, honestly, that sounds really fascinating. And I think it's going to be interesting to see. Will you like share your results afterwards? Like, will you blog about it or, I don't know, do a presentation on it? I think it's going to be interesting. I think you're going to learn some pretty cool stuff through this process.
I always plan to, but I don't always get around to some of that stuff. But since I don't have any in-person trainings, maybe I'll have time for it.
Yeah, you'll have loads of time.
Right, because it's not like you're doing stuff right now, uh-huh. Other than making some people in China super happy with all the hardware you're buying from them. Because I'm assuming like that you are now buying in bulk quite a lot, which you know has to be making some vendors pretty happy, even though it's probably not making you super happy. It must have an impact on your economics having to do it this way now, compared to where you were before. It must be a very different undertaking now.
It is. And from the business operations perspective, you know, I've been doing training for almost 8 years now independently. And, it's interesting to run a business for 8 years. It's been profitable for 8 years. It's been a successful business for 8 years. But when you like look at the business side of thing, cash flow is very different from profitability.
Yep.
And so running a business with positive cash flow, like I didn't realize it. The first 5 years I had a profitable business, but I had very bad cash flow. And now I actually have a profitable business that can sustain it. So like, oh, I can actually afford to go and buy all the equipment for, you know, a few hundred people to take this class over the next year and, you know, get all that equipment. And it's not a big deal because, you know, I know that I'm going to have the interest for this. So, you know, confidence, cash flow, it all helps.
It's interesting because it's a little ironic because a lot of tech companies, a lot of companies generally, I guess, I just know more about tech companies, have the opposite, where they're not profitable, but they have cash flow. So it's sort of interesting to hear about you the other way around. But yeah, so what, I mean, how are you feeling about the upcoming conferences? And I mean, it's Black Hat's the big one you're working towards, right?
Uh-huh. Well, I'm feeling confident that like this training is going to come together. You know, my biggest worry is about equipment. So when I'm teaching a class, equipment breaks. And I normally have spares of everything, but when I'm teaching a remote class, it's not necessarily that easy. So I've put a lot of additional checks into the course, like, oh, before you do this, check this. Before you do this, check this. But yeah, that's going to be the big one that comes up is, you know, when I run this class at Black Hat, is anybody's equipment going to break? Are they going to be unable to finish the class? And again, that falls back on the asynchronous part of thing. I'll send them replacement equipment. They'll get the chance to go and fill in the blanks. But when you're hoping to get this class done in 2 days, and then your equipment breaks, it's going to be pretty tragic. So I'm worried. That's the one thing I'm worried about.
Mm, yeah, I can actually understand why. So look, I have one more question. Tom might have others, but one of the things that we really focus on, as you probably heard in the intro for this podcast, is, you know, when people have taken on projects, try and do something cool and different, and that exploratory quality that you know, sort of going out and forging your way. And obviously everything you're talking about is that, right? You've come across some like pretty major roadblocks and you've adapted to get over them, which I think is very laudable. And I think it'll be really fascinating to see what the outcome of that is. One thing that we do ask people is, you know, for other people who are looking at climbing their own mountains and taking on their own huge challenges, wrestling their own bears, whichever way you want to put it, what advice would you offer?
Well, so there's two levels to that. There's the, you know, what advice do I have someone who's looking at training as a possibility? And then what for anybody in any generic task. The training in particular, it's interesting to see what we have for InfoSec training. We have a lot of experts on topics, teaching classes on those topics, and that's great. And we have some people who are like dedicated trainers who are also training as well. And if you think that you're like, oh, I'm an expert on X, I can teach a class on X, that is true. And you can teach a class and there will be an audience for that. But if you want it to be a profitable business, you have to consider like, well, how many people want to learn X? And how many people a year can I teach X? And how can I make sure that I am sustaining a market? So like, you know, don't just jump into it and say, I know X, I can teach X. That is great. That is an important part of this. But don't think that throwing it and turning it into a profitable primary business is as easy as it looks.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
On the other side of things, the more general, like, you know, you've got a challenge in front of you, what do you do? Iterative approaches just work. So when I got into the training, the first training I did is my second DEF CON. I went into the Hardware Hacking Village with a bunch of kits teaching people how to do side channel attacks on an Arduino, right? And then I kind of refined that. I went back and I had a workshop that I did at a couple B-Sides conferences, well, at the Hardware Hacking Village at DEF CON, on doing FPGAs, basically basics of FPGAs and how to use them. By doing that, by showing up with equipment, by handing it out, by teaching people, even though it was an hour to a 3 hour workshop, you know, I got through the steps. Like, that's how I got the knowledge of how I should be doing it for a 2 day class or a 4 day class. So it's, you know, the more practice you get, the better you get at what you do. So take advantage of that. The other thing is, if you keep doing it and you're not getting better, then you're getting worse.
No, that's true.
I also really like the, you know, the idea that an experiment is worth a thousand theories. You know, you can get into analysis paralysis, and at some point you have to try and see what happens. And I think that is good advice. Just really quickly, those technical terms you just mentioned, I always try and make sure that people explain the technical terms. I'm not sure that everybody that listens is as technically capable or knowledgeable, because I'm pretty sure that my mum makes up for at least half of our leading listeners.
It's an Arduino, which is a system on chip, right, kind of thing. Well, an Arduino is a whole board, obviously. But your side channel attacks. Go ahead. What is a side channel attack, Joe?
A side channel attack is when we look at how long it takes a process to happen in order to figure out more about what's going on. Basically, it takes longer for it to calculate an almost right password or key than it does to just, you know, say, oh, no, your password is the wrong length, so it's totally wrong.
Got it.
And there was an acronym you used.
FPGA. FPGAs are field programmable gate arrays. If you can imagine a CPU or a microcontroller, this runs code. It runs a bunch of instructions, a bunch of programs. And so you can make your own code and programs and plug them together. You can use libraries. And that's kind of like the level of building with gears and pulleys and stuff. But if you go the next level down with an FPGA, you're using gates. So it's like you're using Legos to build the gears to put together to make the machine that does the work. So FPGA is just kind of like a layer underneath what you might expect in a microcontroller. They're pretty useful for when you want to get very precise timing or fast protocols.
That was super helpful. Thank you very much. I would, Bree, for the record, I would like some sort of like Jargon Buster to play every time I make people. But we can work on that in post. It's fine. Don't worry. Joe, thank you so much for taking time out of your vacation and your bear wrestling to talk to us about this stuff. Good luck with your training program. I am absolutely super interested to hear how it goes. So I hope that you'll come back at some point and tell us how it went. And give us a little update. We would love to hear more about it.
Sounds great. I'd love to give you an update. I'm really looking forward to seeing how this goes at Black Hat. Hopefully I will have some success to report on. I'm sure that some parts of it will fail. And that's the setting us up for the next round of success, right?
Right. Yep. I love that philosophy. I completely agree. It's all good learning opportunity, which, you know, for somebody who does training is what you're all about, right?
Exactly.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Joe. We really appreciate it. Good luck.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks, Joe. That was awesome. I hope that you don't get eaten by a bear. It would be devastating to everybody coming to Vegas.
Or beaten by a bear.
Or don't get eaten by a bear either. That would be really bad. I'm just going to leave it at that and not start trying to find other words that rhyme with eaten or beaten.
All right.
I'm still thinking of them, though. Are you thinking of them? So back to stuff and security. Todd, save me from myself. What's happening in security at the moment?
Well, tons of stuff. But the thing that I'd love to talk about is a little report that Rapid7 put out. Yes?
What?
Producers of this very podcast.
Never heard of them. What?
Yep. A little crass self-promotion here. We put out a fairly hefty tome on the state of the internet. It is an internet atlas, basically, of what's going on the internet today. And it is called the NICER Report. And you can go get it at rapid7.com/NICER. So if while you're waiting for that thing to load, here's what it's about. The NICER report is a study of the internet as a whole in terms of exposure along matrices of national exposure, industrial exposure, and cloud exposure. So that's where the N, the I, and the C come from. And we take a look at, it's kind of reacronym, backronymed. I mean, it went kind of back and forth there. At this point, I'm not sure what came first, the name or the subject.
Oh, it's the classic chicken or egg problem.
It was a super fun report to write because we get to nerd out a lot on all of the protocols that make up the internet, not just the web. When you talk about the internet with most people, they probably just think of the web, but hey, it turns out there's a ton of other stuff on there. And a lot of stuff that probably shouldn't be on there. So we talk a lot about the prevalence of SMB servers, of which there are about 500,000, the prevalence of telnet servers, of naked database servers, so scandalous, and all kinds of other stuff. And basically, we break it down into really kind of three or four like core takeaways. One, there is still a whole bunch of clear text, not encrypted stuff on the internet. Ask me why that's bad.
Why is that bad, Todd?
Well, I'll tell you. It's not. Thank you for asking.
Such a surprising question.
I know.
This one seems a little self-explanatory. Like some of the others, I think I really will be like, why is that bad, Todd? But on this one, I'm like, yeah, that's obviously terrible.
Well, crypto gives you not just secrets, but it gives you authenticity too. Cryptography controls give you a way to say like the machine you're talking to is actually the machine you think you're talking to. Like there are cryptographically provable identities, right? And it also gives you an assurance that the data you're getting from those sites on the internet has, you know, not been tampered with in transit. If someone's going to tamper with them, they're going to tamper with them way earlier, and that is much harder to do. So it really gives you kind of like an assurance, not just that you're keeping secrets, but that the secrets you're keeping are, in fact, the secrets you think they are. So that's good. You know, when we get bent out of shape when we see things like Telnet consoles hanging out on the internet, because Telnet does not give you any kind of crypto, just in general. But speaking of consoles, that's another thing that we kind of talk about a lot in this report, is just like the prevalence of console access across the internet. The internet was designed with this in mind. The whole idea of the internet was like, I could type on my keyboard here and it would run commands over there. And then the data, the results of those commands would come back here. And that's great. And that is super innovative when you're in 1969, when all this stuff is getting invented. It's a different world today.
It is.
Wait,
what? It is. I'm always saying that nothing ever changes. Are you saying things do change?
Things change over time, turns out. And things like threat models happen. So the internet is not just a collection of academic computers anymore. It is all computers. And so when every computer can talk to every other computer, turns out they will. And so when you have these consoles exposed on the internet, and they might be Telnet, which is super bad, and that's clear text. They might be SSH, which is better, but still a console in many cases. Or things like RDP, which is Remote Desktop Protocol, or VNC, which is Virtual Network Computing. Like any of these kind of mechanisms for typing commands on a computer and getting results, they should be, you know, kind of safely tucked away behind a corporate VPN or maybe your school's VPN or something like that, or at the very least have some kind of second factor of authentication. SSH works very well with like Duo stuff, for example, for 2FA. 2FA exists for all of these mechanisms, and that second factor may be just like log into a VPN first, or it may be like your more traditional 2FA where like you get a text or something like that, right? That gets you into a place where like not everyone can just walk up to your keyboard on the internet, right? And that's kind of what we're predicting against. And the thing is that, and we talk about this a bunch in the report, go read it. We see a bunch of these Telnet consoles hanging off of kind of like core router infrastructure. So things like the routers that run ISPs for whole countries may have Telnet exposed on them, which is, you know, just waiting for someone to guess the right password, and sometimes they're using defaults. So that's like a big, that is like to at the level of like a national security issue where we find these things. And speaking of national security, you know, we are talking to governments around the world, mostly Five Eyes, maybe a couple other friends, of like what they can do to like help with this. We've written this report with them kind of top of mind. We're also writing to cloud providers, the folks that are giving platform as a service, internet as a service offerings. We had thought that maybe cloud providers would be making things better because, you know, they're new and they don't have a bunch of legacy just built in. But it turns out people are shifting their legacy from their data center to the cloud's data center. And that's also a problem. And we talk about that a lot in the report.
So, I mean, obviously, like, it sounds like the findings are interesting and there's lots of findings. Perhaps, like,
there's like 80 findings in here. It's a lot.
It sounds like they're maybe not going to shock security professionals. But on the other hand, it might help them to understand where to focus attention. And
And having taken a little shifty through the report, one of the things that I really like about it is that for each section, you've sort of given a TLDR to make it easy to consume. You've given an attacker's perspective, as well as a defender's perspective. And then you've given actionable guidance, and you've broken that out by the security and IT people, the cloud providers, and policymakers, which I think is an awesome way of doing it. So I feel like even though it's a hefty report, it's very easy to dip in and out of it and pull out the most relevant parts to whoever you are as a reader. One of the things that we do whenever we're interviewing somebody for the podcast is we always ask them, you know, if they've taken on a project, why did they take it on? Like, what was the thing that drove them to do it? So, like, I will ask you that same question. Why did you do this report?
It's a little mini interview in the rapid rundown. So, we took this on. We were going to do this anyway at the beginning of the year because, you know, we like to keep track of like what's going on the internet and answer questions like how many SMB servers are there actually, just kind of normal questions like that. But then as we started ramping things up, COVID happened. we ended up redoing like all of our data collection, targeting specifically like the last 2 months of March. That feels like it. The last 2 weeks of March, and about the first week and a half of April. And so, because that period really captured like I think what the new normal of the internet was going to be, right? Because Asia was just starting to exit lockdown. Europe and the Middle East were in the throes of lockdown, and US had just started lockdown. US is already in lockdown maybe a week or so. And so we expected to see a ton of change there. And we expected to see like everyone opening up all their firewalls and saying like, forget that security stuff. We need to get work done. Right. Turns out that didn't happen. And that was itself kind of shocking for security people. For the folks on this.
Yeah, but it was kind of cool.
It was, it tells me that the internet, as an invention, one of its design purposes was to withstand physical attack, withstand like some kind of physical disaster on the planet. Well, we have one, and it's a biological virus followed by, a recession, so an economic disaster. And the internet seems pretty resilient against that, turns out. I was surprised that not only did we not see like a whole bunch of new insecure services show up, we actually saw a reduction in some of our favorite bugbears, and that's SMB and Telnet. SMB was leading the pack. Like we lost like 16% of the total SMB population. So while I say there's still 500,000 SMB servers, that's lower than the almost 700,000 SMB servers that were there in 2019. So that was pretty great. And that was like a real interesting finding. So anyway, the long way around to that is we need to like measure the internet fairly routinely to see like what's going on and where the trends are and what people can do to make their own corner of the internet more secure compared to their neighbors. And also more tactically, I guess, and more immediately, what are the effects of COVID and recession on the internet? And it turns out internet is chugging along.
Which is great, actually. Job done.
It is great. It's not exactly that. one of the themes that we kind of came into on this report was like, things are getting better.
I sent some dots here.
But dot, dot, dot. Yeah. It's not getting better fast enough. We still see like a long tail on patching, on version up, like whole version upgrades for certain services. Like we see SSH servers that are 14 years old. So I know they're vulnerable.
Let's just take a moment here to say, I think if we've learned anything over the past few months, and hopefully we've learned lots of things over the past few months, not patching is a terrible idea, people. I get it's hard. It is really hard. We understand there are genuine reasons why people don't do it, but there have been a lot of category 10 severity vulnerabilities during the rounds.
There are Cat 37 vulnerabilities.
right. I've lost one of the category
ones. As we record this, like virtually every like remote access technology out there has had some kind of pretty major bug and fix.
It's so weird that people are scrutinizing remote access at the moment. So strange,
right? Like, and exactly, your intuition, I think, is correct, where people are looking at this because we rely on it like 10 times more today than we did a year ago.
Yeah.
And so things like firewalls, VPNs, routers, all of these things are like very much under scrutiny right now. And we're seeing all these, we see all these patches come out, and it's great that we have patches and it's great that we have coordinated vulnerability disclosure, but like it is that last step.
Yep.
We will see, right? In our report, we talk a lot about like the lack of patches and the lack of even just like basic vulnerability management and version management and asset management. Check back in October, because that will be right around the 90-day mark from this last crop of really kind of terrible vulnerabilities. You know, one of them is going to get exploited in a big way for sure. Because like if I saw a patch uptake rate of 50% of the vulnerable population got a patch within 30 days, I would be ecstatic. Like that would be so much better than we're at right now, for anything. Like, and that is kind of the mind-boggling thing. It's like, I guess management. I don't know. Let's blame the bosses. Why not? that like the things that we put on the internet are not perpetual motion machines, right? Like we do need to kind of keep them going and keep putting work into them to make sure that they're doing the things they're supposed to do. And I think that people are reluctant to like patch things that don't seem broken, right? Because that's
right.
It's counterintuitive. It's one of the problems with security. It's like you don't know it's broken until it's like really broken.
yeah, but that's how we ended up with WannaCry being the problem that it was, right? Is that
you know, the patches for WannaCry were released in February and WannaCry happened in May, right? So like you had big air quotes, plenty of time to get to it. And a lot of folks didn't get to it. So like, I think that we need to just be kind of constantly kind of reassessing like how fast can we patch and how reliable can we patch? It's on the vendors too. Vendors should be releasing patches for security and security only, no feature updates or no feature removals or things like that. Like just security only patches would be great. You know, some vendors are great at that. Some vendors are not so great at that, and some vendors do both, you know, so it is sometimes a grab bag. But I would say that, like, if you're on the hook for maintaining any of these remote access technologies, and if you don't remember the last time you patched, you definitely out of date. And if you patched maybe 2 weeks ago, like June-ish, you still have a lot of work to do. So sorry, but that's kind of where we are.
So you know how I'm always telling you not to speculate wildly, because it's a bad thing to do too much. I'm now going to ask you if you want to place a bet on which of them it is that's going to get massively exploited.
Oh man, there's so many to pick from. It's like, it's like playing roulette, but like with no colors. I mean, I have at least 30 to pick from. if I wanted to cause like maximal chaos, like that Cisco Telnet vulnerability was pretty bad. And it's bad for a couple reasons. One, if you're running Cisco gear, which is fine, like Cisco's great and everything. You should not be exposing Telnet to the internet, you know, full stop. And so you've already kind of failed before you've even got to thinking about patching. You've already exposed Telnet, which tends to mean like you have kind of lax border security controls, you know, and so like, and it's a good vulnerability. It's a remote code execution. So like, if I get control of your router, I get control of your whole net, I can flip it on and off. I can do all kind of weird routy things with it.
And we have exposure data on that sort of indicates that the exposure to that one is pretty high, right? And also I feel like I've heard anecdotally in the company that we've like had conversations with people who've been like, well, we had no idea that was hanging out there. It shouldn't have been hanging out there. So yeah. I would say to organizations, even if you think you definitely don't have it, double check.
Yeah. And like my call to action there is like, hey, ISPs, just turn off Telnet. See who complains, you know?
Yeah.
Because like there's really no good reason to have Telnet on the internet anymore. As an aside, I play some dopey ASCII games, and they've all converted from Telnet to SSH. So if my stupid gaming community can do it, so can you. There is another vulnerability I like a lot as an attacker, and that is the Windows DNS vulnerability. It's a little bit harder to mitigate because you need that Windows DNS to run like Active Directory. And so it's always going to be running inside. So like you can't say like, just turn off that DNS and you'll be fine. Like that's not going to work. but that thing seems pretty bad. There were way more Windows machines running DNS on the internet than I was expecting. I think we clocked in at right around like 40,000-ish.
Wow.
Not quite 50,000, which is, you know, in the space of millions and millions of machines, like that doesn't seem like a ton, but you know, I own that one Windows DNS machine, and that is a straight shot inside your network to almost all of your, like if you're running Active Directory, then I get all that. And so I get everything. That is a good kind of slam dunk. So those are my wild speculations. Cisco Telnet, Windows DNS.
I appreciate the wild speculation. We will see what happens. Hopefully you'll be wrong and there'll be no exploitation of any of these things.
I'm sure it'll be wrong. It's summertime. Hackers take vacations too.
Right. Sure. They're all playing themselves. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for talking me through all these things, and thank you for the magnificent research report. If you are interested in reading NYSA, and you really should be, even though it is a biggie, but it's super easy to dip in and out of. I think you can get to it by, I'm going to say, rapid7.com/NYSA.
Rapid7.com/NYSER. And it is well chapterized. You can put it down and pick it back up again.
I had no idea that chapterized was a word, but okay.
I just made it up.
All right. So thank you so much. And check out the report. And thank you to Bree, not just for taking on the amazing job of editing this podcast, but also because she also edited the beast of the report. So,
holy macaroni. Yep. Could not do it without her. I couldn't do any of this without her.
And thank you again to our special guest, Joe. Good luck in virtual Vegas. We hope that all your virtual dreams will come true, or at least your virtual training will go very well. Until the next episode. Thanks.